Welcome. Welcome to the Dr. Lake Show. This is Dr. Paula Lake. Experiencing a beautiful day here in British Columbia and happy to be here this morning to discuss a really important topic. I think something that maybe isn't talked about enough in the public realm is the concept of parental alienation, which I will have my guest, Dr. Larry Waterman, talk about what parental alienation is. Dr. Larry Waterman has been a guest. I can almost say he's a regular guest here. He's been here on a number of occasions. But one of the reasons he's present with us today, because he's here to talk about what I think is a very, very important topic. Again, like I mentioned, of parental alienation. And he's probably one of the better people I would know to even talk about that kind of topic, because he did and has been involved in numerous custody assessments at one of the primary roles of the few psychologists that actually take on that very challenging task to do custody assessments. And that is something that Dr. Larry Waterman has done for many years, dealing with lots of divorces and lots of challenges as a registered psychologist, who he is now a retired psychologist. But nonetheless, this is a really valuable. We're hearing from someone who's very much an expert in this. So glad, Larry, Dr. Waterman, that you're here today.
Larry's fine. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I know. I've seen you through the years working with families and working on custody issues. And my sense is you were quite thick in the midst of understanding issues around parental alienation. I don't know how much the public understands that term. I'm wondering maybe if you could help people understand what is that? What is parental alienation?
Okay, I think probably a good place to start is by talking about what it isn't, because that's where a lot of the criticism of this phenomena comes from. And I won't go into the groups that tend to try and negate it, but I'll simply say that they tend to be the groups that are most affected by it or engage in it. And they don't want this concept to be out in the public, because they want to believe that what they are doing is being the best possible parents that they possibly can be. So before starting about the characteristics of parental alienation, let's be clear that this is not something you see where there's a history of any kind of child abuse by one or both parents. So there's no history of physical abuse. There's no history of emotional abuse. There's no history of sexual abuse that can be found. There's no history of addiction of any kind by either the parent who is engaging in this behavior or the parent toward whom it's focused, which is unfortunately the vast majority of people who engage in this behavior are mothers, and it's directed towards fathers, and the goal is to try and get the father out of the child or children's life, period, end. That's the whole purpose of this. But when we do the investigations, as I said, we can't find any real basis for what is happening. It doesn't make sense. There's no evidence of any of the things that I talked about a few minutes ago. In fact, quite the contrary. Often the alienated, and I'm going to say father because that's the majority, has had anything but a good relationship with the child. And I'll give some examples as we go through about what I mean. So having said what it isn't, let's talk about what it is. So we have a situation, let's say, that parents have separated. It's an acrimonious, it's not a nice divorce at all. There's a lot of anger involved, and there's usually some history between the parents, but not necessarily involving the children. So at some point, people start to notice that, I'm going to just keep the singular, so this child who appeared to have a good relationship with his or her father starts to turn against that father for no apparent reason. And there's eight characteristics, and these were first identified by Dr. Richard Gardner down in the States. I think he was working in Seattle in 1985 or six. And he talked about something called parental alienation syndrome. And that's the first thing that I want to address, because it's unfortunate he used the word syndrome, because syndrome has a very specific meaning, as you know, in psychological research. And parental alienation doesn't fit the characteristics of a syndrome. So I prefer to refer to it as a behavioral manifestation of what's happening between the parents. So let's go into the eight characteristics. First of all, the child starts being totally negative towards the alienated parent or father in this case. Says that they hate the parent, gives all kinds of reasons why they give the parents or why they hate that parent. But when we investigate, it's interesting that there's almost a roteness to what the child says about that parent. When they talk about the parent, they'll repeat almost word for word the same sentences and the same accusations and the same allegations in exactly the same terms. So that's the first thing that we look at and say, wait a minute, what's going on? There's been no past behavior to indicate why this would happen. Secondly, the child will engage in what are considered to be, they've referred to as weak, frivolous, and absurd reasons, like, well, he didn't get me an ice cream when we went to the grocery store 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
And I wanted an ice cream. He said I'd have to wait till we were on our way home. And I was mad at him. And that's not fair. And that's why I hate him. Those kinds of nonsense, ridiculous things. The third characteristic is the child doesn't show any ambivalence whatsoever. So anytime you try to point out to the child, well, you went on a vacation with your dad last year and everybody said you had a good time. You were playing with your cousins and it was all the way in Alberta and you had a great time. No, I didn't. I was just pretending.
Wow.
It just totally negates whatever's happening. And I didn't want to stop at the amusement park and I didn't want to stop at the water slides. I didn't want to do any of that. I just did that because he made it. Okay. So child is absolutely 100%. I hate that parent and that's all there is to it. Another real big red flag in these situations is the parent who's alienating the child. In other words, the parent who's trying to turn the child against the other parent almost always will say, it's the child's decision. The child has a right to make up his or her own mind. I'm not going to intervene. If he or she wants to see her father, that's fine. They can do that. If they don't want to see the father, I'm not going to force them. So the parent just absolves himself of any responsibility whatsoever. When you talk to the child, you get almost an automatic response whenever you bring up the topic of parent who the child considers the good parent, the one who's alienating. So the good parent can do no wrong whatsoever, and that's often because the good parent lets the child do basically whatever they want. And in fact, will go out of their way to make sure they provide whatever the child wants in an effort to make sure that the child remains bonded to them.
Wow.
And as we all know, as good parents, there are times we have to set down boundaries. And that's partly how children learn. But in these cases, there are no boundaries. It's whatever the child wants. As I mentioned before, there's no real guilt on the part of the child. So even when people point out to the child, well, you know, I can show you videos and pictures of having a good time with this parent, the child will just totally deny it and show no remorse whatsoever. Doesn't matter. Case in point, I was doing an assessment a number of years ago involving a 7-year-old girl. And this was a rather unusual situation because the court had already awarded interim custody, in this case, to the father. And it was the father who was trying to turn the child against the mother. So the child was going on and on about how much they hated their mother and how she never had any fun with her mother and all of that sort of thing. So I talked to the mother about that and she said, well, I've got lots of photo albums of things that we've done together. Here, I'll give you a couple of photo albums. Why don't you go through them with the child? And I said, fine, good idea. So I sat down with the child and I started going through an album that they had done when they were down at Disneyland. And every picture where the child was smiling, laughing, obviously having a great time, the child just totally denied. No, I wasn't happy. I was just pretending. She would have got mad if I said I wasn't having a good time. So I just pretended the whole thing. I did. Just absolutely hated it.
Wow.
And the other characteristic that is really interesting is the child's hatred of the other parent spreads to that parent's relatives. So grandparents that the child was previously close to all of a sudden are hated. Cousins that the child loved to go and play with now doesn't want to have anything to do with. Aunts, uncles, anybody involved with that parent's family is totally disregarded and rejected by the child. And as I said earlier, there's no basis for this when you actually go in and start to do the assessment. Okay?
Yeah. So it has a huge impact on, you know, a child. I'm wondering, are there vulnerable ages for children to be influenced by their parent when the separation actually happens, that they're more susceptible to that kind of influence?
Well, younger children, because they're much more dependent on parents, are more susceptible to be influenced by that parent. So a 3, 4, 5-year-old, for example, if they start to say, oh, yeah, I'd really like to go and play with Daddy at the park today, and they'll get a response like, play with Dad? When did Daddy ever play with you? You know he never played with you. All he ever did was criticize you and get mad with you. You don't really want to go and play with him. And so as the child gets older, there's more of a possibility the child might start to say, well, wait a minute. No, I did have some good times. So it's harder at the older ages to do it. It's still quite possible.
Right.
And one of the reasons for that is if you're a child living with one parent, and every time you mention the other parent, the parent gets mad or gets critical or becomes negative, you're going to learn fairly quickly, don't mention the other parent. Just don't say anything. And secondly, whenever the alienating parent makes a negative comment about the other parent, you're going to agree, because if you don't, that parent's going to get angry with you.
Right.
So
there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure that they're under in those
Absolutely.
Early years.
And
yeah.
We'll talk about some of the very negative impacts it can have on the child.
Yeah.
As how it grows up and develops. And the other thing I think we should mention, because people automatically, and this has been a problem with the courts, actually, to be honest with you, is people think, well, we'll get the child and the parents into counseling and they can resolve all this and everything will be fine. And the research over the years, over the last 30 years, has been very clear. Counseling does not work in these situations.
Okay.
So what the way of intervening has developed and evolved into is the child has to be removed from the care of the alienating parent. Because as long as the child is with the alienating parent, it gives the parent more time and more opportunity to alienate the child. So just taking the child away from the parent for a couple of hours for counseling and then putting the child back with the parent,
just doesn't
the
do
counseling
it.
Gets negated okay. in basically wow. no time at all by that parent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we had a very good program by Dr. Ray, who unfortunately had to shut it down after a few years. It was in the Okanagan. And what would happen would the child would be ordered by the court to be taken away from the alienating parent and immediately taken to Dr. Ray's program. And they would stay in that program for about 5 days. And the first couple of days would be spent on deprogramming the child, trying to help the child see that what they were saying was not valid, that the parent was in fact a good parent, that the parent in fact loved them. Then for the last 3 or 4 days, the alienated parent, the one that the child hated, would be introduced back into the child's life with supports in place. Right. And they were there 24 hours for 3 or 4 days, whatever was needed. Then after that, the child would not be placed back with the alienated parent, but would be placed either with the other parent, if that seemed to be acceptable, but often would be placed with a more neutral person, usually a member of the alienated parent's family. So for example, in one that I did recently, I recommended that the child be placed with an aunt and uncle here on the island, even though the child lived off the island and somewhere else. And that's what we often see. I was involved in a file many years ago, and it's public knowledge, it's Fry versus Fry. And what I recommended in that case was that the child be removed from the mother's care, because she was alienating the child from the father, and placed with the child's aunt, with whom she had been very close. And fairly quickly, the child redeveloped a relationship with the aunt, even though she was dad's sister, and it was doing very well. And then dad was slowly introduced in that situation. That was before Dr. Ray had her program. And over time, the child reestablished a good relationship with the father. Mm-hmm. And then we gradually started reintroducing the mother into the child's life under supervision. So okay. She was not allowed to see the child by herself, and that continued for well over a year. I think it was about a year and a half until we felt that that everything had been resolved to enough that the child could then be allowed to go out on outings with the mother without supervision, but could not stay overnight with the mother because that took another 6 months to a year before that could happen. So that gives you an idea of everything that's involved. And you're right. They're very complicated situations.
Huge.
You have to be very careful. You don't want to re-traumatize the child.
Of course.
You want to do what is in the child's best interest, which, mm-hmm. of course, is always the aim of custody and access assessments. But trying to get the court, as I say, to listen, especially in the early days. It's much better now. The courts have gotten much more educated about this phenomenon now. But I can remember over 20 years ago, I was testifying in Duncan, and I presented all of the information which clearly demonstrated that alienation was taking place. And this goes back to that case where the father was alienating the child from the mother. And at the end of the day, after my testimony, I was told by the lawyer that the court just basically ignored everything I said and said they knew better than I did, and they had an opportunity to see both parents in court, and they were going to leave the child with the father. And he was, by the way, allowed to move to the Kootenays. So the child lost all
so unfortunate
with the mother.
Yeah. I mean, how resistant is the alienating parent to any kind of modification of the role that they're playing? How stuck are extremely? Okay.
Extremely. Okay. They're extremely rigid. And that goes back to something that you and I have talked about before, which is personality disorders.
Yeah.
In these kinds of very nasty, litigious divorces, one or more parents usually, and by usually I mean well over 95% of the time, have severe characteristics of, say, narcissism, of psychopathy, exhibitionism, and even borderline personality characteristics.
Right.
So, because of this, they are not open to feedback at all, no matter where it comes from, whether it comes from the court, whether it comes from doctors, whether it comes from teachers. They're just going to ignore it because they know what's best for their child. That's all there is to it. They want the other parent out of the child's life. And don't confuse them with the facts. My mind is made up is basically the attitude that they have.
I mean, I could see how there would be an element of narcissism because to be a concern for the welfare of the child versus, it takes a lot of compassion and empathy to understand the needs of a child, and if you can't really observe that and recognize that as a need of the child, then somewhere there's something that's not quite working very well, right, for them and being able to perceive that.
Exactly. And that's you just touched on one of the problems with bringing these cases to court. Is the alienating parent, the lawyer for the alienating parent, will parade in a whole list of witnesses just lauding the praises of this parent. They're a wonderful parent. They're wonderful. Like, I would leave my children with this parent anytime for as long, and I'd be perfectly happy. And to some extent, they're right.
Yeah.
Because these parents are desperate to be the very best parents they can actually be. And so they will do everything. They'll start up programs, they'll go into debt, allow the child to go into activities they want to go. They'll do anything and everything to keep the child bonded to them.
And so there's
outside looking in, they look wonderful.
Well, I mean, to consider that a parent is also enabling their child. So there's an element there where could you call it a form of manipulation? Because in allowing that child to have all their needs, every need met, and catering to the child's needs, that could also create another problem, right? Because I think children need to learn boundaries and those pieces. So, they may be overly doting and present, but there's a little bit of an edge of control within that, right? On the parent's part,
yeah. And they have to maintain that control in order to continue alienating the child successfully against the other parent.
Now, I know we're, right now that, you know, we have a good portion of the population that does get divorced and separate. And you know, in my mind, this has been a very serious issue. And I've certainly witnessed it even in my younger years and seen parental alienation at work. And I've seen the damage of it. How prevalent is it right now, do you think?
That's a very interesting question. If we go back and we look at the number of people who get divorced and end up in nasty divorces, so it's not mutual, it's nasty, and there's a lot of fighting, going to court, and that sort of thing, that's about 10% of the people who end up getting separated and divorced. Okay. Now, out of that 10%, we used to say 10% of them, or 1% of the overall people who get separated and divorced, engage in these kinds of behaviors. In my experience, I think it's become more prevalent. I would say probably closer to 2 or 3% of those people. Yeah. And I think part of that, ironically, is public education. Because parents who don't want their child to have anything to do with the other parent can readily find lots of information about child-parent alienation on Google, for example, or on the internet. And then it lays out a map for them exactly what they need to do in order to turn that child against the other parent.
So you think they actually study it, sort of?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I've had parents admit that I found out about this stuff by going on the internet, and I didn't want my kid to have anything to do with their dad, and so I thought, okay, this is what I need to do. Fine, this is what I'll do. And I'm doing it to protect my child, because the child is better off with me, and they shouldn't be with the other parent, because I don't trust that other parent. They're not nice. They're nasty. They treated me badly, even though they may have always treated the child very, very well.
I mean, I think, you know, this is highly traumatic. I mean, you know, in a family, this kind of disruption from everything I've seen is very dramatic and you know, acrimonious. And, you know, children can get right in the middle of the battle, right, between the two parents. And so I think it can't be understated for me that this is a significant issue and has a pretty severe consequences on a child and the family when this happens, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Give you another example just to make the point. One of the first cases that I was involved in was a very, very nasty case. The mother was alienating the two girls against the father.
Right.
The father went to court a number of times and was finally able to get custody of the children with visitation to the mother. And that went on for a period of about 6 months. And then the mother somehow managed to get false passports for the children because the father was holding the children's passports. She kidnapped the children and took them to Europe. Oh. And it took him 18 months using private detectives and going over to Europe himself and trying to follow up leads until he finally found them. Then he had to go to The Hague in Holland and make the argument that he should be allowed to take the children home. He was granted that as long as a social worker from Canada came and accompanied the children home. So he had to pay for a social worker to fly to Amsterdam, get on the plane at the front with the two children. He had to sit at the back because he wasn't allowed to have any contact with them. And they flew to Vancouver and then finally to Vancouver Island. The children were kept in the ministry's care for a period of time until the ministry decided that, yes, they really didn't hate their father. They really could live with their father. And there was a court order still standing that the children were supposed to be with the father. So they allowed the children to go back. Mother has never been back to Canada because if she does, she'll be charged and probably convicted and go to jail for what she did with kidnapping the children. So the mother has continued to try to keep her, did continue to try to keep contact with the children through emails and phone calls and that sort of thing, until finally the father had it. He just shut down all communication because it was so disruptive and so negative for the children, moved out of province and has been gone ever since. He did email me about a year later saying, by the way, just so you're interested, both of the girls are now old enough to realize what their mother has been doing.
Right.
And when when she tries to contact them now by email, because she still manages to get their emails, they just tell her they don't want anything to do with it. So interesting.
I mean, you know, there's a point where they, you know, they're in the position to make that decision. And when they're older and they have a greater level of awareness of what's actually happening, and that's okay, right? I think the issue is when they're young and they're so vulnerable. Why do you think that it tends to happen? I know historically the preference for custody issues around separation was to have the mother be the caretaker. And historically, yes, that was, you know, where the mother was considered the more important parent to be doing the primary caretaking. That's changed, right? So I'm assuming it's changed.
It's changing.
It's changing.
It's certainly improved. The courts have learned now to evaluate each parent and not just one parent. And there is a greater capacity to get judgments that say joint parenting or sometimes even sole parenting to the alienated parent. So it is, yes, it is improving and it is getting better. Unfortunately, there's still judges out there who do not believe in parental alienation, and simply will either they don't understand it or they don't want to understand it, and they just really refuse to take that into consideration. But it is improving, and that's good.
I hope so, because I actually see this as highly damaging for the families involved. And I've witnessed myself some parents that have experienced alienation and from their ex. I've seen the heartbreak. You know, I one parent in particular was devastated. I mean, it was the wife had a personality disorder. She actually very deliberately had told him her plans to alienate, that if he left her, he was never going to be able to see his children. And so this was a very intentional, exercise that she took upon herself. And the father that was the one that I knew was absolutely a loving, caring, gentle, person, beyond heartbroken. This is after even 20 years of not having the opportunity to see his child, is still trying, even well into adulthood, trying to see his children. But they had established such hatred for him at that point that it was, I could just visibly see the heartache that it caused. And so I just see sort of collateral damage going everywhere when something like this is happening in so many ways, right? So
that's true. And you know, I've had a number of cases over the years where pretty well all of them, except for the one that I mentioned, were fathers who fought to try and see their children and fought for a number of years in court and other ways. And finally, they would just give up. They'd say, you know, I'm out of money. I'm in debt. I've done everything I can possibly do. I can't do this anymore. It's just destroying me.
Yeah.
And so they said, what I'm going to do is walk away and I'll try and keep in touch with the kids, Christmas and times like that and their birthdays. And hopefully when they get older and they'll understand what's been going on and they'll make contact with me. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
One father, for example, did send Christmas presents to the children every Christmas, also sent gifts to them on their birthdays. Later found out, a number of years later, the gifts were never given to the children.
Oh,
as soon as they came in, unbelievable. The mother would give the gifts to charity and looked like she was being a nice person. But when she did that, she'd unwrap them, throw away the wrapping, say, come on, kids, we're going to donate all these gifts down to the Goodwill or whoever. And so the kids thought it was wonderful. They didn't realize they were giving away their own gifts.
And likely denying to the children that gifts ever came.
Oh, absolutely.
So the children are in the dark.
See, your father doesn't care. He doesn't send you any gifts. Wow. He doesn't care if it's your birthday or Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, it's just hearing about it, I can't imagine that kind of experience. And it just seems beyond for me that people can actually think to do something like that. But it is true. And I know you've been witness and seen the damaging effects of that. What are the consequences of this kind of parental alienation when it unfolds in a separation?
Well, there's a whole myriad of consequences. And I'm going to start by saying what alienation does is it increases the probability of some of these things happen. We're not saying in every case they're all going to happen or even will happen. But let's say there's a 20% probability of a child becoming an addict as they get into teenage years. When they go through alienation, that probability goes way up. So there's a much higher incidence of alcoholism, drug abuse, promiscuity, acting out behaviors, getting into trouble with the law. It also has an impact, as you can readily see, on that child's ability as they get older to develop relationships. Yeah. Because they don't have a model of how to be in a relationship with the alienated parent. So if a mother has alienated a child against the father, then that child has never developed a relationship with that father. They don't know how to be with a man.
Yes.
Okay. And whether that's a male child who doesn't know how to develop a good friendship with another male, or whether it's a female child and starts to affect the child's ability to form a relationship of any kind, whether they're dating, getting engaged. So what we see is a history of numerous relationships, most of which fall apart because the child breaks them off or doesn't want to remain involved or gets too overwhelmed or gets just doesn't know how to proceed. And so they stop seeing the person. Not surprisingly, we see a very increased probability of separation and divorce for these kids when they grow up. Mm-hmm. Because again, they don't know how to be in a relationship like that. It's not part of what they grew up with. And that's what part of what children get when they grow up with, you know, a mother and father. And I don't want to get into this whole same-sex thing because it's a whole different topic. But, you know, children learn from both parents that they're with. And if they don't have an opportunity to learn from one of those parents, then they're at a real deficit in terms of how they proceed in terms of their healthy development. Yeah. And they don't grow up to be very healthy in many cases, which is really sad because they don't know what's wrong because they don't really understand it unless they've managed to figure it out, which some kids do.
Right.
And then they reestablish contact with the alienated parent. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen very often.
It's really unfortunate. The term of attachment, the issue around attachment, which we know Ainsworth and Bowlby that did work on that, is that, you know, children can develop either an insecure attachment or avoidant attachment. And avoidant attachment is based on the concept that, you know, they develop a sense where they look at the other as perhaps untrustworthy. So they develop models of the world, and their model might be, I'm not worthy of love, or I cannot trust this love. And I would imagine it sort of sets children up for that kind of insecure attachment with perhaps the opposite sex or the parent who was alienated, that their attachment would be impaired. Would that make sense? Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
And that's a lifelong process. It can be lifelong. This may be something that, you know, I've certainly seen where the level of rage or anger and bitterness and resentment that a child holds about their parent continues and into their adult years. It can continue into their adult years.
It can, definitely. Yes.
Yeah. So
and it's ironic, too, because if the parent or if the child, when they grow up into an adult, recognizes that they have a problem and they go in for counseling or therapy or whatever you want to call it to try and get some help, because they don't really understand what's happened to them, it takes the therapist a while to figure out what's probably at the basis of the problems they're having, because you have to ask a lot of questions, get a lot of background history, and gradually it comes out, well, I have no relationship with my father, for example, and I haven't had a relationship with my father because he's a horrible person and I hate him since I was 3 years old. When he left mom and I, he didn't support us, and mom really struggled to take care of me, but she did a great job and she's a wonderful mother. And I don't know why, I just can't get along in relationships.
Wow.
You know, and then that gives the therapist something to work with.
Yeah.
And they can usually flesh it out from there.
So it's good for them to understand parental alienation, really.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially these days. You know, if you go back a number of years, number of decades, there's been these recurring themes in, unfortunately, families. In the 70s and 80s, for example, there was sexual abuse allegations. So mothers would make sexual abuse allegations against the fathers in order to get custody of the children and in order to keep the children away from the father. And that went on for a number of years until research started to show that the vast majority of these allegations had no basis in fact. And then the courts were educated. They sound funny for us to educate the court, but they're human like everybody else.
Yes, of course.
And that's what's happened with child-parent alienation. It's taken a while, but gradually the courts are understanding it. And now when you use the term, even the lawyers will understand it. And they will often bring it up because they've been informed by an expert, whether it's psychologist, psychiatrist, whoever, about what's happened.
Why do you think men are primarily the targets of parental alienation? I mean, I know it can go both ways, but why does it turn out to that? I mean, I find it interesting that women were originally, I almost wonder if they have a sense, greater sense that they that's their deserving. But what's your thought on why that happens?
Well, I did custody and access assessments from 1982 until I retired.
That's a long time.
A long time, yes. So I had a chance to see hundreds of these situations.
Yeah.
What I found was when most parents separate, they both look for their power center. For men, the power center is often money. They're usually they were anyway, and still are to a large extent. They're the ones who are financially caring for the family. Okay, so they earned the money. They had a good lot of say in what happened to the money,
right.
And that became their power center or focus of control, if you will. Mothers quickly realize that their power center are the children. Now, if the children continue to have a good relationship with both parents, that decreases mom's power center. And if she's really angry with dad, and as I said, in the vast majority of cases has severe personality disorder on top of that, the perfect logical conclusion that they reach is keep the kids away from dad. That'll protect the children. It'll punish dad. I'm the better parent anyway. And so the kids should be with me, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure they stay with me because that's where they belong.
Interesting. You know, I one of the things I thought about, as we do in business, where I had set up a partnership agreement with my partner when I started a business with her. And what I liked about that whole process, and not to say that that's what we should do when people get married, however, it stipulated exit plans and you predict all possible things that could happen, and you set that a stage for that. And you and I talked about sort of when couples meet, the things they don't talk about in a relationship that they probably should talk about to prep for that. Do you think there's any, there would be any foundation to having people who, before they get married, I mean, it's a reality right now that you might have 50% that get separated, some form of education, some form of agreement or understanding that should these events happen, do you think there's anything that can be done prior to the launching of children into the world to start to prevent this or different strategies for that?
I think it would be excellent if we did that.
Yeah.
And I think that would be in some ways a much better use of education than some of the ways we use it now. When couples get together, you're right. There's areas that they typically don't talk about. Those areas are typically politics, sexuality, financial, and certainly they don't talk about what are we going to do if this doesn't work out, because they don't even want to think about that.
Of course not.
Because they're just in the honeymoon phase and everything's going to be wonderful and
sure.
I'm going to be taken care of for the rest of my life and we're just going to have this honeymoon.
It feels like it puts a damper on the fantasy, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And there's arguments can be made for that. You know, prenuptial agreements, for example, are one example where some people are strongly in favor of them and other people are strongly against them for exactly that reason. Well, why would I have a prenup if I'm going to marry this person and be with them for the rest of my life? That just is sort of setting up that, well, I know this isn't going to really work out, so I better make sure I get what I need now.
Well, sure. I mean, I think, the same conversation happens around wills, which I find interesting because having dealt with seniors is, I remember talking to my family and I'd say, well, you thought about a will? Well, you know, and they think they're in their 70s. They're saying, well, we're not dying yet. And so there's some kind of idea out there that if you talk about something, that it might actually, contribute, or there's some fear around the conversation around it. And honestly, when I went through, even in business, when I went through a partnership agreement, I remember at the time that I was setting up this agreement legally, thinking, why are we doing this? I mean, we're not planning to have this dissolve or anything to go wrong. After it was done, I was very grateful for it. I mean, I went along with it because I thought it ultimately was a good idea. But I can understand that. You know, there's how it does that. Yet, I can tell you that once that was done, this is one of those situations that when you have thought about it and prepared for it, you're not as scared of it. And that if it should it surface, that you have some kind of means to knowing how to deal with it because it's already been kind of considered and planned. And I think it's unfortunate that we have that initial hesitancy, right, to go into those conversations.
Well, it's kind of ironic because talking about agreements and education and that sort of thing, one of the things the government has done here in BC, and I suspect in other provinces as well, is when parents separate, they will often be ordered by the court to attend a course called Parenting After Separation, because yes, there's a recognition that parenting when you're separated is very, very different than parenting when you're together. Yes. And any problems you had parenting before, which may have led to your separation and divorce, are just going to be exacerbated by the separation and divorce. So any little thing that one parent does is going to anger the other parent much more than it probably should. And when you throw in the whole thing of severe personality disorders as well, it can get very complicated and very nasty very quickly.
I know I recall one situation that I encountered, and I actually believe that I consulted with you on this case, and this was many years ago. And the situation was, it was very much a parental alienation. The parent was wanting to alienate, the children from the father. There was, and the parent was given consent legally to move to another province. And that sent, this husband, parent was grief-stricken, absolutely adored his children, was heartbroken by this. And the question was, is there a way for me to, I know that parental alienation is happening. There's a recognition that this is happening. And how, is there anything I can do to ameliorate the negative consequences of it, as with the parent that's alienated, is there anything they can do when they know, when they witness that there's alienation happening where the courts may not have recognized it? What is there anything a parent can do who is being alienated to try and lessen the impact of alienation? Like how much contact, what should be happening for them to try to sustain that relationship with their children?
To be blunt, there's not much they can do.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
I have one remaining file, even though I've been retired for some time. Mm. And it's not an active file. It's a file I was involved in a number of years, about 15 years ago, when I first did the initial custody and access assessment, or Section 211, as it's now called. Then they brought me back a couple of years later to do a second follow-up assessment. And as a result of all of that, the mother was allowed to move out of BC to another province. Now, the father in this case is a well-respected professional, makes very good money, and he's been fighting ever since that time to get regular access to his children. I was talking to him just a few weeks ago, and he said it had been 10 months since he had had any contact whatsoever with his kids. And this means he would leave where he lives here in BC, and he would fly to the other province where they live, and he would be denied access and have to turn around and fly home without seeing
it's
the children.
Horrible, horrible. I can't even imagine.
And the odd time that he has had the children, he has been allowed to have the children come and visit him, the children have been so happy they don't want to go home. They want to stay with him because they're having such a good time and they do all kinds of fun things and they get along with him really well. But when they're with their mother in the other province, they refuse to talk to him on the phone. They refuse to have contact with him if he comes to visit, probably because mom sets them up for that. But that's a good example. It's been over 12 years now. He figures he has spent well over $1 million on trying to get access to his children and has basically nothing to show for it except that being in court something like 38 or 40 times or some ridiculous amount trying to get what he needs. And he's still trying. He's not willing to give up. But he's the exception. Most people do give up because they, number one, they can't afford it. Number right. two, they just get so depressed and start to take over their life, which pretty well has for this fellow. And they still don't get any satisfaction. They still don't get to see their children.
So that's the decision that they may have to that make at some point, is that if it's causing too much damage for them, that they need to step back and start looking after caring after themselves. I can appreciate that. And I mean, it's unfortunate. I think if there's nothing, and I certainly have seen those situations, children not responding and keeping anger and keeping anger even well into adulthood, refusing to talk to their other parent. And, you know, so I guess if this is something that a parent, and I think if I recall, one of the things at least that you and I had talked about in the past is, if there's a chance that you can see and be in contact with the children, that makes a huge difference. But the very inherent nature of parental alienation is that you're kept at a distance just by that, by the influence that they're having over their kids. Is there any, you know, short of legal, because I'm thinking right now, I'm so glad to hear that legally, we have the system is starting to recognize the legal system is recognizing it more. But is there reparative? Is there something, you know, I can imagine parents that are listening to this, especially ones that are alienated, are wondering, okay, but what can I do? Or is there anything? So if there isn't much they can do, you know, in their efforts to be in contact, what do you think we might need to do to bring it even forward further, either to prevent it? I'm thinking, what do we have? We have education, having parents, you know, I've always wondered why parents don't have some kind of parental education when they're in the early years before they consider having children. We have licenses to drive car, but you know, we can bring up children without that kind of concern. Could we do education? Does a legal system need to be better equipped to recognize it? I mean, the problem still continues. You know, do we need more education out there in the public sphere? Because I don't actually in the media hear a lot talked about parental alienation. I it sounds like in the courts they're recognizing it more. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that.
I wish we could basically eliminate it through education. But when you think back to what I said about severe personality disorders and bitterness,
right,
and all of those kinds of variables that go into separation and divorce, it's pretty hard. Even though people know intellectually what would be best for their kids, they don't do it.
Yeah.
Give you another example. There's a resource here in Nanaimo called the Men's Resource Center. And that was started by a man who was involved in a parental alienation situation. His wife alienated his children from him. He fought it for 5 or 6 years, finally walked away and said, I just can't do this anymore. I'm broke, but I want to do something. So he started the Men's Resource Center, which basically is a support center for, at the time he thought, men. But as it turned out, they are used by both men and women, because women get alienated as well.
Yes.
And so they find when they go and talk to people at the Men's Resource Center, lo and behold, people understand what they're talking about and say, yeah, I've been there. I know what you're talking about. I know. And they can talk about things they've tried and what's worked and most of it hasn't worked. They're an interesting organization. I became involved with them because they actually got a grant from the government to produce a video about parental alienation. And I was asked to be the expert in the video and also to consult on the video, which we ended up doing. That was about, I would say, 15, maybe 16 years ago, or maybe a little bit more. When that video was completed, it was sent out to every family lawyer in British Columbia.
Wow.
They are still floating around out there.
Yeah.
The Men's Resource Center still has copies of that video or DVD now. And upon request, my understanding is they will send you, if you pay the postage, a copy of that video, which outlines everything we're talking about today in a lot of detail.
Okay.
And is a really good summary of this whole topic.
Is there a website there to link it to, or for people to have access to that?
If they just Google Men's Resource Center in Nanaimo, it'll come up. I know they're still functioning because I just read the other day or other week that they have a new executive director. The person who founded it has finally said, I just can't do this anymore. And he's walked away. He's just burnt out.
I bet.
So they hired a new executive director and he's just taken over. So I haven't had a chance to meet him yet, but I plan on doing that in the near future just to see if I can be of any support or assistance to them, given my background in this area.
I could see that being a valuable resource in every city where divorces happen to have some kind of center, because I think that's an invaluable support that the parent needs who's being alienated. I think to know that there's other people to be able to talk about it. Certainly it's not fixing the situation, but it helps to know and have allies and people that really grasp what parental alienation is, because I could imagine a parent feeling quite alone and trying to explain to everybody what is going on in their family situation, and let alone the fact that if a court has, let's say, the parent has it, that your appeal or efforts to try and change the situation have not been recognized by the courts, sometimes you would feel even more alone because legally you're not even being recognized for what's going on. So when you're not having that kind of validation, which usually the legal system can give that, you're explaining that to people. People don't always understand, right? They just see that the courts have not upheld or taken your side, and there might be some, you feel like you're having to justify and explain what's happening. I think, at least that's something. And in terms of education, do you think it's possible that, we can incorporate that? Do you know why maybe this isn't talked about as much? Have you seen many parental alienation programs out there, or in your experience with this?
No, as I said, Dr. Kathleen Ray in the Okanagan did start a program. It was running for about, I think, 2.5-3 years, and she was getting referrals. She was internationally recognized as an expert in the area, would give expert testimony both in Canada and down in the States, and she based her program on several programs down in the States, and they all followed that same model of taking the child away from the alienating parent, reuniting with the alienated parent, and then gradually introducing the child into a more normal relationship. Okay. Part of the trouble with convincing people of what's happening is, I go back to what I said earlier about the parent who's alienating the child to the public and to the outside looks like a wonderful parent.
Yeah.
They love their children. They love other children. They'll go out of their way to do anything to help. Most people around them think they are just absolutely fantastic people. And so when they alienate a parent, they say the father in most cases says, you know, my wife is doing, they're looked at like, yeah, there must be another reason. Your wife is a wonderful parent. I would leave my kids with her in a nanosecond.
Yeah.
So
it's
what did you do? Did you have a drinking problem? Did you have a drug problem? Did you have an affair?
Yeah.
Why? Well, why?
There's
why?
Something
why
that you did.
Happen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
we also have a tendency, unfortunately, to assume the negative about people.
Yeah, one of the things that I've since I was young is one, I never idealize people. And as you know, working as a psychologist, you also begin to become very aware that appearances can be quite deceiving.
Absolutely.
So you look at things with a little bit more skepticism and wondering what happens behind closed doors. Because I've seen a lot of those situations where people can be very good at hiding certain aspects of themselves and be very deliberate about public presentation, very deliberate about it. And as soon as that door is closed, another person might appear, right? That we otherwise might not see.
Give you an example of that.
Yeah.
In this one case, this mother used to give pictures of the alienated father to the child to put up in her bedroom and would actually go in and put up pictures of the father. And everybody would think, oh, what a wonderful thing to do. Well, of course, as soon as she did that, she'd done such a wonderful job of alienating the child. The child would go in and just rip the pictures down. And the mother would say, see, I tried my best to maintain a relationship. She just doesn't want it.
Yeah.
So there's no point in me trying.
Yeah.
You know?
Legally, do you think that now it's being recognized more? Do you think, and now, fortunately, you've got lawyers that are getting more understanding of it. Do you think there's any different stance that the legal system can take? I know we've talked about the legal system, not always the justice system, right? But is there any stance that can be taken on that part? Because I'm always thinking, how can we start to reduce it? How can we recognize it better? What would be the next step that would move us further towards minimizing this occurrence from happening?
Well, that's an interesting question, given what's going on with the legal system right now. Mm-hmm. And I'm referring to, of course, to the sexual misconduct that was happening in the military.
Yes.
And how it went on for years and years and years. Everybody knew it was happening, but nothing was ever done about it.
Yeah.
And finally, the government has stepped and say, okay, all judges now have to take training in sexual abuse, sexual harassment,
yes,
et cetera.
Yeah.
Including the military police, because they're the ones who investigate for the military. I think something similar for lawyers, if there was a course, for example, in law school on these are the kinds of problems that you'll face if you go into family law, would be very helpful, just in terms
of
making sure they had an understanding of what they're dealing with, because most lawyers really don't, because they don't go into those sort of nuts and bolts kinds of things in law school. You know, they go into the law, but the law isn't exactly always where the problem is. And as you point out, that's why I always had clients refer to it as a legal system and not a justice system, because there's no guarantee of justice at all when you go into the courtroom. And any good lawyer will tell you the same thing. Try and settle out of court, because once you go into court, that's a crapshoot. You have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, you know, I mean, I think maybe all of us face some kind of legal issues at some point. That was a comforting statement that we have a legal system, not a justice system, because it kind of makes you go, okay, it's okay that this is happening, because it's what happens in the system. But maybe that is the next step to go. Especially because of the powerlessness that parents have, it would be that form of education to the powers that be. To be able to prevent, and ultimately for me, regardless, I think it's good for children to be the ones to decide. I mean, certainly short of abuse, actual abuse happening, it is important for children to be able to have that relationship with both their parents. It is good for them developmentally to have that relationship with both their parents. And I think if that is recognized, I think that's really important, right? For the legal system to recognize that. Is there any advice that you would give right now, considering, unless there's other topics you want to discuss on this, that you would give to a parent who is struggling, that is really going through because I think it sometimes can take over their lives when they're involved in this. If they're struggling and being alienated from their children, what would you suggest to them to do to get help, either in any domain with what's happening to them?
I think one of the things, and you touched on this earlier, and we've talked about it a little bit, is finding support for yourself.
Okay.
Because alienated parents feel very, very alone. usually the only people they can turn to for support are either family members or extremely close friends.
Yeah.
And that's all well and good, but these people have not gone through the same experience. And that's one of the things I really like about the Men's Resource Center here in Nanaimo, is that you can talk to people who have been through this, or are going through this, and they understand, and you can share ideas and share support and share what you can do. Of course, you're going to take whatever legal action you take, but that's often not very helpful and very expensive. No, unfortunately, going to court, every time you go to court, it's thousands of dollars. Yeah. And that's the way it is. And if you end up in a 1 or 2 or 3 week trial, heaven forbid, you're looking at well over $100,000, probably closer to $150,000.
Wow.
How many people have that kind of money sitting around that they can afford to use for that?
Not many.
No matter how much you love your children, there's limitations that we all have.
Especially nowadays, given the financial divide. I think that is, at the very least, you know, right now we have the Men's Resource Center to suggest to people here in Nanaimo, BC. And hopefully, you know, even this kind of conversation might motivate somebody to start up some groups in different regions, you know, get this communication about this issue spoken to a little bit more in the media and the public sphere, heighten people's awareness. That's a first step to making those changes. And I have some hope, because as we look at some of the issues, as you mentioned, with the veterans, with the military, that, you know, while it's been going on for years, it's still promising to see that an issue, while even though delayed, it actually might get addressed and looked at in the legal system. So I cross my fingers and hope for that happening. Is there a final point you'd like to make, any leaving comment you'd like to make on this topic?
Oh, I think one of the things that's overlooked in these situations, and only really gets brought up if the matter goes before a judge, is the potential consequences for the child itself. What we're talking about here, and baseline, is we're talking about severe child abuse. You know, if a parent is physically abusing a child, the child gets removed and the parent gets charged. If a parent is sexually abusing a child, the parent gets charged and is held accountable. If they emotionally abuse a child, fortunately, we're starting to catch up in that area as well.
I'm glad
and parents
to hear that.
Can now be charged.
Yeah.
For years, that never happened because it was too hard to prove. But I think if there was more recognition that potential impact of children who go through this kind of child-parent alienation process can be catastrophic in many different, well, all areas of their life, really.
I agree.
Relationships, in terms of establishing boundaries, in terms of raising their own children, in terms of being in a long-term relationship, financially, acting out irresponsibly, consequences in terms of potential law-breaking behavior, the potential for addiction and addictive behavior. The list goes on and on and on. And again, if anyone's interested, just Google effects of parent-child alienation, and you'll be amazed. There's just literally thousands of documents on Google dealing with this topic. And I would love to see what you said a few minutes ago. I would love to see a resource center set up in Prince George and Kelowna and Kamloops and
absolutely.
All over the place.
Yeah.
So people have some place to go. And as I said, even though it's called the Men's Resource Center, that just happened to be the name that the person who founded it chose, men and women both attend that center here in Nanaimo. Yeah. I know that for a fact, and find it very helpful to be able to talk with other people.
Well, you know, and perhaps, you know, there may be opportunities for that governmental support. You know, we have alienation centers that are available to people. And I am very much with you in hoping that legally it gets recognized as a form of child abuse. And there's a recognition of that. And there's some more means. I think as when we put names to things and we start to identify them, it makes it a little bit easier to start to do some work at preventing them. And so hopefully that's going to be the next step, you know, that will
go. Well, it's interesting, you know, because after we made that video, Resource Center got some more money to sponsor workshops. And so I gave workshops in Victoria, in Port Alberni, Courtney, different areas. And they were very well received. And I think that that's the sort of public awareness campaign that needs to happen in order to get more information out there that people can then use effectively.
Absolutely.
Deal with this kind of situation.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Ronerman, thank you. I think this topic is, you know, for me, it's always been very important, and it's been hard for me to actually witness people going through this kind of experience. Excuse me. So I'm hoping that this is going to be a value to those of you who are tuning in and listening to this. And I hope that you get the support that you need. And of course, if you are going through it, for any parent that is alienated, sorry, I'm losing my voice now. My hopes are that they'll get some personal support too. And if they need to do some therapy and work on the process of, if they're going through it, to get some help. And if not a center, but you know, your time, thank you. You took the time to come here and explain something. And as an expert who's been in this area for a long time, Dr. Waterman, I think it's invaluable information for people. And I'm hoping that people will access this as a resource to also get that normalization and validation that these things happen, and to know that there's perhaps some possibility to get some support networks out there. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Great to have you. And I'm hoping to have you again, because it's always nice talking to you. So thank you. And perhaps we'll if you stay on, we'll talk and say goodbye. And thank you to all of you tuning in to the Dr. Lake Show. Today we were talking about parental alienation with Dr. Larry Waterman. Very valuable conversation to have. And I'm hoping that those of you navigating a separation and divorce, hopefully we'll be spared to have to deal with this. But if not, try and get some support and help, and try and learn more about parental alienation. Wishing you all the best. Take good care. Until next time.